The Tom Woods Show, episode 2199.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Dan McCarthy is back with us again. Dan is editor of Modern Age. And his recent Spectator column, I thought, was worth a conversation. He's talking about Trump and DeSantis and how DeSantis could, if he doesn't play his cards right, wind up undermining the very political movement that he himself represents. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Delighted to join you.
All right. We have to talk about Trump and DeSantis because your theory is very interesting to me about the effect that DeSantis could have. Based on the decision he makes, he could wind up doing something that maybe he doesn't really want to do. So there are different ways he could have an impact on the election, and there are different ways he could affect the strength of the, let's say, Trump populist kind of movement. Your article is called DeSantis is a Republican Establishment Win-Win, which is a rather arresting title. So do you mind accounting for yourself here? There are a lot of people who are excited about DeSantis, and you're suggesting there's a possibility that he could inadvertently be leading people down a path they don't want to go.
Yeah, it's a very strong headline, and headlines tend to be written by the editors of publications rather than the authors, which is the case here, but it is a fair headline. I am worried that DeSantis will be used by the Republican establishment as a way to weaken the force of populism, the force of this, kind of insurgent anti-establishment force within the GOP. And even though DeSantis himself is, I think, a populist conservative, what the establishment is hoping is that DeSantis will either divide the populist vote by running against Trump in 2024, or else that in order to cultivate support that Trump can't get, that DeSantis would try to triangulate, as Bill Clinton used to do, try to move a little bit in the direction of the establishment in order to get the votes that Trump is leaving behind, and that those votes would give DeSantis, a boost in the primaries. Probably not enough to actually win the primary against Donald Trump, but enough to really create a stronger divide in the GOP than you see simply between the Never Trumpers and Trump supporters.
Every poll I see, now I suppose these are probably straw polls now that I think about it, and sometimes they reflect reality and sometimes they don't. But when I do see those polls, Trump is overwhelmingly defeating DeSantis. DeSantis is a strong second. He's the clear second, but he is a distant second in these polls. Do you think these polls accurately reflect the Republican electorate? And if so, why would DeSantis even consider a 2024 run?
Well, a lot can happen between now and 2024. There is still 2 years to go before we have a Republican presidential nominee in 24. And, I think DeSantis wants to maintain his profile. And also, DeSantis is getting advice from a lot of not just establishment people, but some folks in the conservative movement who are willing to go along with Trump, but have always been very reluctant to support Trump and would really prefer to have someone else. And these people are telling Ron DeSantis every single day that he should be running and that he has a real chance of defeating Trump. And when you hear that day in and day out, it can have an effect on you, especially if you're a politician, you're an ambitious man. You want to believe it, even if all the polling and all the objective information tends to suggest that it isn't true.
It just seems like there are a couple of good scenarios for DeSantis if he waits for 2028. So if Trump gets the nomination and wins, obviously he can't have another term after that. So then DeSantis is poised to be his successor in some ways because there's nobody else on the horizon. But if Trump gets the nomination and loses, well, then, that means that another deeply unpopular Democratic president will take office, and that clears the deck completely for DeSantis in 2028. So I understand that you might be ambitious, but it seems like those arguments should win the day.
Yeah, I agree. And not only that, but also, you know, DeSantis will be reelected as governor this year. And it seems to me that after he has a successful second term under his belt, which will conclude, right, you know, a year before basically the Republican contest for 2028 kicks off, DeSantis, you know, by then will have a strong two-term record and will be ideally positioned to run as a candidate for 2028. He'll have, you know, a full year basically to put together his campaign team, and he'll have, you know, a powerhouse record. What I worry is that, you know, in trying to get DeSantis to run prematurely, a lot of people, some of whom do have goodwill, some of whom are, you know, their hearts are in the right place, but I think they are taking a fairly young candidate and they want to see, you know, someone run on the COVID issue that, you know, was paramount for the past 2 years. They want to see someone run as DeSantis would against Disney and against Drag Queen Story Hour. And those are real issues, of course, but I do think that in 2024, those are not going to be nearly enough. And so I'd like to see DeSantis, you know, have another 4 years here as governor and really build up some expertise on a number of other fields and not just be a candidate who's known for one or two issues.
Let's talk about Trump then for a minute. I don't know the extent to which this document problem at Mar-a-Lago is a problem. It may well be. And obviously, people are going to work overtime and go into overdrive to do everything possible to throw every... If we thought they threw every obstacle in Trump's path last time, that would just be nothing compared to today. What's your assessment of that? That there could be, well, the types of obstacles that he might face, including the results of this FBI raid?
It's the same sort of hype we've seen with every other Trump scandal, where progressives take any investigation into Trump, whether it's being run by William Barr, or whether it's one being run by the Southern District of New York. They always say that Donald Trump is about to get indicted. Donald Trump is about to get sent to jail. This is a perpetual fantasy for American progressives. And so they're running through this right now with the documents that Donald Trump held on to after his presidency. The National Archives said, oh, those documents should really belong to us. And they sicked the FBI on former President Trump. The documents, I mean, they may touch upon, you know, nuclear secrets. They may touch upon any number of things. But the way the media is spinning this, you would think that these are documents that, you know, are of the utmost strategic importance because they're classified and because they may talk about foreign leaders or what have you. But of course, it seems very unlikely because, I mean, the National Archives has known for, you know, well over a year that Donald Trump had these documents. If these documents were really as sensitive as progressives are making them out to be, they would not have waited as long as they did in order to get them. So I'm sure the documents, you know, touch upon some important issues, some, you know, classified materials and whatnot. But I also don't think that they are things that the ordinary American and the public would consider to be absolutely outrageous for a former president to have. It could be something like, you know, mementos of Trump's discussions with Kim Jong-un, for example. That would involve a foreign country's nuclear plan. It could include things that the National Archives would really, you know, want to hold on to and would consider highly classified. And yet things that would have very little, you know, sort of real material impact upon the world. So I don't think that you're going to see any kind of indictment or arrest or anything dramatic like that coming out of this whole episode. But I do think you're going to see the FBI continue to try to embarrass Donald Trump as much as possible. And certainly the media is not going to let up.
All right, let's fast forward to the 2024 election. And let's suppose you are advising Donald Trump. Now, I suspect he's not as difficult to advise as people might think, but more difficult to advise than a lot of politicians. And you want him to, let's say, go to his strengths, and you want him to work on some of his weaknesses. What do you think are weaknesses he has, weaknesses that might be shooting himself in the foot?
I think one of his weaknesses is that he can sometimes get distracted and that he can make things entirely about himself when in fact he could do better by focusing on a number of themes and issues. So in 2016, for example, I think he did extremely well by talking about immigration relentlessly, by talking about the failures of U.S. foreign policy, by talking about the need for working class America to catch a break and not have an economy that is designed basically for a college educated elite. If Donald Trump returns to those kinds of themes, I think he'll be very successful. In 2020, unfortunately, it seemed as if it was mostly going to be about how wonderful his own administration had been. And of course, by 2020's final phase of the presidential reelection campaign in 2020, you were dealing with COVID, you were dealing with an economic crisis brought on by COVID, and you had riots in the streets of America. And at that point, Americans were not thinking about all the wonderful things that had happened for 3 years while Trump was president. They were simply thinking about the crisis they were in right at that moment. I think it would be a very big mistake if Donald Trump were to make the 24 election an attempt to relitigate 2020. And there were times in 2021 when it seemed as if maybe that was something Trump wanted to do. But it does seem to me that in the last several months here, as Trump has gone back on the campaign trail, unofficially, of course, that he's done a very good job of not simply making his appearances about refighting 2020, about talking about, past elections. Instead, he's been focusing on the failures of the Biden administration and the future of the country.
I'll tell you what I think one of his weaknesses is. We've already been over, his personnel appointments, and there's some reason to think he might be better in the future if he ever had another chance. But he goes on his instincts a lot rather than being heavily briefed on the details. And you may say that doesn't matter because obviously he did well without knowing all the statistics the way Ron DeSantis does. But when he was asked about critical race theory, he was against it, but he couldn't really explain what it was. And then Biden was able to say, well, look, I think we all agree that, we shouldn't call people names they don't want to be called and we should be respectful toward each other. And so he was able to get away with implying that that's what CRT was because Trump just was too bored to bother to get the details. I'd say that's a weakness.
I agree. I think that was the low point of Trump's 2020 campaign. He seemed ill-prepared for the debate. He didn't really have an answer to that question. And his administration at that point had actually just issued a fantastic executive order, basically getting critical race theory out of the federal agencies. And this was a triumph that Trump should have celebrated. And instead, he was not really prepared to describe even what his own administration was doing successfully. I think that he probably learned a lesson from that embarrassment. And it does seem to me that he's a little bit re-energized on the campaign trail, quite a lot re-energized, in fact. So I'm cautiously hopeful that, as I suspect, he will run again, and he'll run again in a pretty disciplined way. And he's still going to be Donald Trump, of course. He's still going to be a very spontaneous candidate. But I think he's going to be more like Donald Trump of 2016 than the one who was pretty lackluster in 2020.
What do you think is harder for him in 2024 as compared to 2016, and what's easier?
Well, I think what's easier is that Donald Trump is a great critic of the establishment. He's a great critic of all the things that the sort of bipartisan elite had done wrong ever since the end of the Cold War. And he's actually been very consistent on this. You can go back and look at things that Donald Trump was saying back in the late 1980s, and they are consistent with the themes that he was enunciating in 2016. So I think that Donald Trump is actually very comfortable going out into the field, critiquing what Joe Biden has been doing, critiquing what, sort of the Mitch McConnell Republicans have been doing. I think Trump is great running on a fence against the other side. I think he's, in a more awkward position when he has to play defense, when he has to defend not just his own administration, which he was capable of doing. He didn't necessarily do it well in 2020, but he was quite capable of it, I think. But also defending Washington, D.C. itself, because at that point, if you're president, you can't say that you're running against Washington, D.C. You seem to be Washington, D.C. And, maybe what Trump should have done in 2020 is to make it clear to voters that there is a difference between the executive branch, which, of course, is largely the deep state and the administrative state, versus the president, as opposed to the impression most people have, which is the executive is simply whatever the president wants done, the federal bureaucracy has to do. What people didn't really understand, I think, is that Donald Trump was in some ways at war with the swamp and the swamp creatures throughout his first, 4 years in office there. And that a president is not necessarily powerful enough to get the kind of change that needs to be taking place, get it done within a single term. Especially if you are, like Donald Trump, coming from totally the outside, you simply don't know how government works. You have a lot of experience in business where people would never do the kinds of, things that the federal bureaucracy can get away with in thwarting a president's will. I think Donald Trump, going into 2024, is going to know a lot better as to how thoroughly he needs to crack the whip upon the federal bureaucracy. And that if he does that, he'll be successful. So I think, I'm hoping that, as I expect, he will run in 2024. And I think that that will be one of his themes, that the federal bureaucracy is out of control, the deep state is out of control, And we have to take our country back from these permanent bureaucrats as much as from the Biden administration.
It seems like the forces arrayed against him, though, I don't think initially in 2016 he realized how powerful they were and how determined they were and how numerous they were. Now he's got to realize it. I mean, more than anyone on this earth, what he's witnessed, he has to realize that if he were to get in, the only way he could survive is by absolutely cleaning house in major departments. I mean, obviously he can't abolish what we might want him to abolish just on his say-so, but he has got to just clear people out in huge numbers. And is he prepared to do that is the question.
Oh, I think he is. I think he learned a very painful lesson at the end of his administration. And, you know, there were people in the administration who were well aware by that point of what had gone wrong, of the fact that, you know, you had government officials leaking and sabotaging presidential policies all down the way. And that if you want to have an effective administration, a successful administration, you have to have control over the federal bureaucracy. If you don't have that, if you let them defy you, if you let them get away with it, then you're going to be completely sunk. This is not, of course, something that only happened to Donald Trump. People who are old enough will remember that Ronald Reagan had some of these same problems, that Ronald Reagan came into office, you know, in 1981. He brought with him a lot of his old friends from California. He brought in some, you know, solidly conservative folks. He also brought in, unfortunately, some neocons. And Reagan was never able to get control of the federal bureaucracy and to cut it down the way he wanted to. And that's why he wound up leaving office with a federal bureaucracy that was much bigger than it was when he came in. There were some people in the Reagan administration, like Donald Devine, for example, a former colleague of mine from the Fund for American Studies. Devine, you know, knew what he was doing and really, you know, did everything possible to cut down the federal bureaucracy. And as it happens, I know that the Trump people were reading Don Devine's books and, you know, learning from his experience by the end of Trump's years. And they wanted to use the lessons that Devine had learned under Reagan to help Donald Trump at the end of the Trump administration, you know, crack down on the federal bureaucracy. But by then it was very late in the day. And now, however, I think that if Donald Trump gets back into office after the 24 election, he's going to go in there on day one with a powerful plan for getting the deep state under control. And not just getting it under control, but really cutting it down, reducing its power, and basically exposing what an undemocratic and unconstitutional institution it really is.
What do you think his primary agenda looks like? What does he want to do more than anything in the world? Now, some of it, knowing his personality, is he wants to get back at, you know, people who stood in his way. But in terms of substance, what do you think motivates him most now?
I think basically just the sense that he has an unfinished mission in life and that he is someone who came to politics, you know, from business, from having been very successful and from bouncing back from several defeats in business, right? I mean, he went bankrupt a couple of times. There were lots of times when you had tabloid headlines saying businessman Donald Trump is washed up, and Donald Trump would come back each time and build a new empire. And I think with government, he went in there in 2016, 2017, and, you know, had plans for shaking up the way things were done and basically moving us away from the unsuccessful policies of the Bushes and the Clintons and basically the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War. And what he was not prepared for was the actual nature of government, which is that the federal bureaucracy is an almost untamed, you know, independent beast, which can run roughshod over a president, especially an inexperienced person, inexperienced in government person, who is not prepared to know where the pressure points are on the bureaucracy. So I think that it really is going to be a big part of his comeback effort, is this idea that what he tried to do in the first administration was successful as far as it went, but it couldn't go all the way to completion because it had people within the government itself who were working against it. And this is a battle that Donald Trump is not just fighting for himself and for his legacy. This is a battle that, again, Ronald Reagan tried to fight and found that, you know, even after two terms in office, that the task was still undone. And of course, what a lot of Reaganites hoped for back in 1988 and 1989 was that a third term, a George H.W. Bush term directly succeeding Ronald Reagan, would see George H.W. Bush continue Ronald Reagan's, you know, relatively conservative policies when it came to the federal bureaucracy, that, you know, with the Cold War winding down at that point, that there would be a real chance for some drastic change at the domestic level. And George H.W. Bush, of course, instead pointed us in the direction of creating a world empire and becoming, you know, this permanent policeman for the globe. as well as raising taxes domestically, as well as doing a number of things domestically that expanded the scope of government. So that betrayal by George H.W. Bush of Ronald Reagan really derailed the conservative movement for a good long time, basically throughout the next 25 years or 30 years even. And Donald Trump was an attempt to get things back on track, to try to really, once again, make the will of the people effective in Washington, D.C. And of course, that's never going to be entirely the case. You're always going to have, various forms of self-dealing among bureaucrats, and you're always going to have, self-interested politicians who will, sell out the country. But Donald Trump was actually an attempt by someone coming from the outside to take the reins on this runaway horse and try to, stop it from charging off over the cliffs of, again, foreign interventions and terrible monetary policy and any number of other things that were just creating a crisis and a border that was not being effectively enforced. So I think, Donald Trump is re-energized on all those fronts and really wants to make these issues salient once again in 2024. It's going to be hard, though, because back in 2016, even though the media was doing its best to character assassinate Trump, they were still fascinated by the whole experience of Trump running for office. And they dismissed him. They didn't think he was going to, pose a serious threat to Hillary Clinton. And a lot of voters were also just curious about Donald Trump. They thought, this is a novelty. Who is this guy? What does he really stand for? And they were able to project onto Trump, a lot of voters were, things that they wanted him to be. Whereas I think in 2024, Trump is more sharply defined in the minds of everyone. And the media is also going to be hostile in ways that are somewhat different even from 2016. They're going to continue to make Donald Trump out to be a very bad person, as they've done all along. But they're also going to say this guy is now just a fundamental threat to democracy, and therefore he needs to be deplatformed and canceled. And that sort of institutional media war, the deplatforming of Donald Trump, I think that may be quite effective. It was something that even back in 2020, I think the social networks, for example, Donald Trump hadn't been kicked off Twitter yet. But I think you saw a lot of attempts to prevent Donald Trump from using social media effectively. And I think in 2024, you're going to see even more of that.
Hey, everybody, I want to recommend a person to you. And that person is Mikkel Thorup, who was my guest on episode 2183. And Mikkel is the host of the Expat Money Show, which is the number one resource for anybody considering the expat lifestyle or offshore investments. Your host, Mikkel Thorup, has been an expat for over 20 years. He's visited over 100 countries and himself lived in 9. And so he has invaluable insight on the expat lifestyle. And that includes how to maximize international investments, how to move offshore for more freedom, privacy, and protection. You're going to gain vital knowledge on wealth protection, tax reduction, investing, migration, citizenship, residency, you name it. You're going to love Mikkel as a person because he's very knowledgeable without being an arrogant jerk. And the variety of topics he covers on the Expat Money Show, where he's telling you about all different countries, all different things you might want to do there, like buying property or getting a job, all this stuff is covered on the Expat Money Show. So go to expatmoney.com today. The link will be in the show notes. That's expatmoney.com, or listen wherever you get your podcasts. Let's jump back for just a minute to DeSantis. Have you been able to, let's say, gather any clues regarding what his foreign policy views might be?
I see a lot of good signs with DeSantis on foreign policy. He was actually one of the better Republicans when he was in Congress. He was not, always voting with Thomas Massie and Rand Paul against everything that was going amok in our foreign policy. But DeSantis was easily, one of the top 90% best Republicans on foreign policy during his short time in the House of Representatives. And subsequently, I've heard, in person, Governor DeSantis give some talks to some audiences that would have been receptive to a quite neocon foreign policy, including donor audiences of, sort of old guard Republicans who would be very happy to return to the days of George W. Bush. And DeSantis, in fact, has instead talked about foreign policy restraint and talking about the same sorts of attempts to refocus our foreign policy that Donald Trump had talked about. So I'm cautiously optimistic on all those fronts. And of course, the thing one always worries about is what kind of advisors will a presidential candidate or a president have. With Donald Trump, you've got, on the one hand, Trump himself, who could not be fully controlled by his advisors and who always had his own instincts. But Donald Trump's actual appointments in foreign policy were often, disastrous, as was the case with, most spectacularly with John Bolton. with Ron DeSantis, you're going to have a different risk involved. DeSantis, I think, is going to be a more professional, to use a word that has maybe a double edge to it, but he'll be a more professional politician. He'll be more polished, and he will be more aware of who he's investing in when it comes to his personnel decisions. But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of conventional Republicans, a lot of neocons even, trying to get into Ron DeSantis' circles. And they are going to, you know, present the case to him that they are good, card-carrying Republicans, very loyal people, and therefore they should get, you know, a foreign policy portfolio or some other portfolio. And in practice, when they got power, these people would be doing the same sorts of things that a John Bolton would be doing, for example. And I think that the same sort of greater professionalism and efficiency that might characterize Ron DeSantis might actually make bad advisors all the more powerful and all the more effective. Because with Donald Trump, bad advisors can only get so far because Donald Trump just didn't really care about advisors and didn't really care about, you know, the usual sort of deference to professionals that you see among well-polished and sort of well-tutored politicians.
You know, when Trump is good, he can be pretty darn good, like on energy policy. A lot of people who don't like him otherwise have to admit he's the best guy around when it comes to that. That's for sure, especially in the current environment. But then I listened to one of his speeches and he's talking about the death penalty for drug dealers. Like, we haven't tried stuff like this before. And so on the one hand, he's willing to break with the party establishment and be very bold in some ways, but then really conventional, disappointingly conventional in others, like playing to his base. I wish he would say to his base, look, we've done everything we can do on this front. You know, we might as well try to launch the war in Iraq again. I mean, there's no point in doing this. We have to try a different approach. So I was a little disappointed to see that. Maybe I'm expecting too much.
Well, I think Donald Trump is right to talk about the skyrocketing crime in our country right now. And as always, Trump will have very bold policies that are kind of shocking. And that might include, you know, things like the death penalty for drug dealers. These are not policies that are likely to be actually implemented, but they do signal to the American public that Donald Trump will take a much harder line on crime than we've seen the Biden administration take or that other Republicans would take. And frankly, I think that is the right line to take politically. The policies will need to be thought through more carefully once you're actually in office. But, I mean, you know how things are going right now, Tom, where, you know, if you own a store, a bodega in, you know, anywhere, it could be Washington, D.C., it could be New York City, it could be Baltimore, it can be a small town even, you can't do anything about shoplifters now. If shoplifters want to come in and just, you know, ransack your shelves, you can't lay a finger on them because if you do, first of all, they're going to resort to violence against you and the cops are not going to help you. The cops are going to stand by and do nothing. This is because the cops have been intimidated by the left, which, you know, has basically said, we're going to, you know, prosecute the police for trying to stop criminals as opposed to prosecuting criminals. The country is on the edge of real lawlessness here. I mean, it's already experiencing it, and it's on the edge of getting a lot worse. So someone like Donald Trump needs to come along and say, we're going to throw all of this machinery into reverse. We're going to start putting the criminals, you know, away for a very hard time in prison. You know, I was someone who, while crime rates were dropping in the middle of the 2000s, just like everyone else, I thought, you know what, maybe we need to revisit some of these policies like three strikes and you're out. Some of these, you know, policies that put people in jail for very long times for what seemed like minor infractions. But the fact is, unfortunately, that the logic of these heavy sentencing laws was correct, which is if you put people away for a long time for minor violations, seemingly minor violations, you actually will prevent them from getting out and doing, you know, far worse things over time. And you can look at all of these, you know, just horrific cases that have been in the news lately about women who've been kidnapped and murdered, all the people, you know, doing these kidnappings and murders, all the people who are pushing people in front of trains in New York City, you know, getting them killed on the subway. These people all have rap sheets, you know, a mile and a half long, and they are rap sheets that escalate. They start out doing, you know, minor stuff, and then they keep, you know, moving up to assault, moving up to attempted homicide, and then eventually, you know, they surprise no one by actually following through and committing the most heinous deeds. If these people are not locked up permanently, you're going to continue to see this country descend into violence and just, you know, I mean, it's disgusting what's happening. You have little girls getting, you know, shot by, you know, gangbangers who are firing off their guns, you know, at random against crowds, you know, in Chicago and Baltimore and D.C. You have psychopaths in the New York City subway system who are pushing women downstairs. They're pushing people into, you know, moving trains. You know, this has to end, you know, forcefully right now. And Donald Trump, I think, I mean, you know, really one of the great weaknesses of Donald Trump in 2020 was he didn't tackle the crime issue much more effectively. And I think that's going to be one of the key questions in 2024.
Pedro Gonzalez at Chronicles Magazine has quite a thread on this exact topic. Maybe I'll jot down a note to link to that on exactly the kinds of incidents that you've been talking about. The issue here, though, would be I don't want the federalization of crime control either. The key thing needs to be to make clear that when you have a clear victim, as in these cases, and justice is not served, or the victim has been victimized by somebody who had no business being out in the first place, the key thing for Trump or for any Republican would be simply to broadcast to the states and the attorneys general that you use your judgment and you're not going to be constantly second-guessed unconstitutionally by the federal government. I mean, that alone would go a long way toward solving that problem.
Well, I have to say, if a state or a city is not going to enforce the law, you really do have to think about the citizens in those states and in those cities and whether, you know, you sacrifice their lives because they happen to have a bad Democratic prosecutor or a bad Democratic mayor or, you know, other forces that are involved that are basically suspending the rule of law in these places and causing innocent people to get murdered. And it seems to me that is something that just as the left would go out there and they would say, look, if you have a state that is not enforcing the law and that is allowing, you know, black people to be lawlessly, you know, lynched and otherwise harassed and, you know, exposed to violence and murder in any part of the country, that is a legitimate cause to bring in federal law enforcement if the local law enforcement is not only not doing its job, it might be on the side of lawlessness. Similarly, if you have progressive leaders in a number of states and cities who are not doing their job and who are letting innocent people be murdered by criminals, you do really have to start to think then about using the proper constitutional powers of the federal government to at least put pressure on these localities and states to enforce the law. And, you know, where necessary, federal law will have a certain amount of priority. So I know this is something libertarians do not like to hear. And, you know, people who put federalism as their highest priority, which is normally the right thing, they don't like to hear this either. And normally I would agree with them. But I think we have to really look closely at the policies that some of these localities have adopted, which are, you know, getting innocent people, innocent children in many cases, simply killed. And there are times when you can actually, when you have to step in and prevent that from happening.
That actually would be an interesting topic of conversation at some point down the road. I understand where you're coming from. I mean, part of me thinks, well, I don't want to set the precedent whereby if our side, let's say, normal people who don't have a fetish for criminals. And by the way, that is not some right-wing fantasy. The left, for an incredibly long time, has had this weird, oddball attraction to criminals. It's not just that they want to read them their Miranda rights and other people don't. It's not that. It's a genuine... I mean, I think Leonard Bernstein actually participated in a fundraiser for the Black Panthers at one point. So there's a long history of this. So I get that. But there's a part of me that thinks, I don't want to set the precedent of the federal government intervening for a good reason, because then when the power is in the other hands, they're going to use federal law enforcement to enforce their crazy ideologies on everybody in every neighborhood and every school. And I don't want that. But then I think, well, whether or not a precedent is set for them to do that, they're going to do that anyway. You know, so whether or not Trump or DeSantis or anybody else in the White House has such and such crime policy, they don't care about precedent. The left does not care, but they don't say, ah, look at what Trump did. Now, this will give us pretext for doing what we want. They're going to do what they want anyway.
Yeah, and not only that, but I mean, you already see that to be the case, right? The FBI is already used to, you know, sort of instigate a lot of plots that are just used in order to publicize the FBI itself. And I mean, I'm thinking of things like, you know, the supposed plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, which was largely something that the FBI created. I mean, it was something that the FBI, you know, they went to a bunch of idiots and said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we did X, Y, and Z? Oh, by the way, here are the, you know, sort of plans and materials by which we can do X, Y, and Z. And they got a lot of, you know, these idiots who, you know, you can say any number of criticisms about them, but they did not have on their own the initiative to come up with a plan to kidnap the governor of Michigan. And yet the FBI basically went in there and created the possibility for them to do that. all in order, to, then have a sting operation and give the FBI credit for supposedly foiling this dastardly scheme. The FBI does all kinds of things like that. And, the raid on Mar-a-Lago, the way in which the FBI has been politicized against the enemies of the Biden administration, this has been going on for a long time. And all those applications are illegitimate. And if Republicans, take a very strict view of the limits of federal law enforcement such that, we're not going to protect the civil rights of, innocent citizens who are being killed and injured and maimed, sort of raped and horrifically abused by criminals in places where criminals are protected by left-wing prosecutors and by, sort of left-wing democratic governments. If Republicans say, well, on Federalist grounds, we're not going to touch any of that. All that is a purely local matter. You can have, a sort of Mad Max environment in your local area, and that's none of the business of the federal government. The idea that that would somehow inspire progressives to say, oh, you know what? You're so principled there that we are not going to use the FBI in any of these political ways. We're not going to have any more Wacos or Ruby Ridges or other, abuses of federal law enforcement power. You're right. You've set such a powerful moral example for us that we're never, ever going to do that kind of thing. That's clearly a scenario that you and I can't possibly imagine. And again, it's one that for decades now has in practice already been disproven. The left will use all these powers to the maximum. That doesn't mean that your reservations are misplaced, however, because anytime you create some sort of new intervention or new pathway for federal power to be used, there is every possibility that the progressives and the left are going to use that power. So you don't want to do that, but at the same time, you also don't want to leave people defenseless by saying that you're going to somehow set an example of being so perfect or so good that you're going to therefore, sort of inspire the devil to stop being evil, when in fact, people who are already very, very happy to use federal power for nefarious ends, they're going to keep doing that no matter what kind of example you set.
You sent me an email in this chain that we had back and forth that mentioned that you have a brand new issue of Modern Age out. You want to share some highlights of it with us?
I do. We have the summer issue of Modern Age is out right now. It includes an essay by Walter McDougall on Angelo Codevilla and John Quincy Adams. Now, those are some names which your listeners may or may not be familiar with, but those are basically three of the most important names in U.S. foreign policy across over two centuries. So John Quincy Adams, of course, I think your listeners are familiar with. Angelo Codevilla was a great foreign policy thinker who died about a year ago. And Walter McDougall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who has been an absolute stalwart of talking about the change in U.S. foreign policy from a policy of defense and a policy of minding our own business to a policy of empire and policing the world. And so McDougall is talking about the important work of Angelo Codevilla and also how Codevilla tried to revive interest in John Quincy Adams and in John Quincy Adams's more small R Republican foreign policy. So that is our lead essay in Modern Age, and it's something that I think is very important and that your readers will enjoy. We have a lot of other fantastic material. We have some material that I think people who, don't want to be hit by too much politics will actually find to be a pleasant relief. So for example, we have Alan Crawford writing about the blues and their geographic origins and a bit of an untold story about the origin of the blues. And I think, people will find both the political material and also the cultural material in the summer issue of Modern Age to be very engaging indeed.
So the website is modernagejournal.com. Remember, Modern Age has been around since the late 50s. It has published anyone and everyone you can think of, including Murray Rothbard and me, by the way. Not that that should be your only consideration, but it goes to show something about the ecumenical nature of the publication, that it has featured a variety of different voices. In fact, it was in the pages of Modern Age that the, well, famous to us anyway, debate between Harry Jaffa and Mel Bradford took place on equality as a conservative principle. So it's been a very important outlet for the exchange of ideas on the right for quite some time. So it's very, very much worth your time. ModernAgeJournal.com. I'll link to it along with the article from Dan at tomwoods.com/2200. So Dan, thanks so much for your time today. Very much appreciated.
Thanks, Tom. If I may put in a quick word, one other project of mine that I'd like listeners to know about.
Oh, please tell them, yes.
A new foreword that I've written for a very important book called The Conservative Affirmation by a writer named Wilmore Kendall. And Wilmore Kendall died back in the 1960s. So you might be saying, well, Dan, what could the importance of a book that was written, you know, while JFK was still alive back in 1963 possibly be for the world of 2022 and beyond? And my answer to that is The Conservative Affirmation, this book for which I've written a new foreword, it is the master plan. It is the constitutional strategy and philosophy of populist conservatism. It was written all the way back in 1963. But you will find going through this book that so much of what it talks about is absolutely prescient. It is far more, you know, sort of on the news right now in 2022 and beyond, even than it was back when it was written in 1963. Wilmore Kendall was a cantankerous philosopher. He was a conservative who was really one of the shaping forces of the post-war American right. And he was someone who understood the importance of populism at a time when most conservatives did not, and the conservatives still had, you know, the sense that they could somehow be above the fray and just be a kind of small remnant without having to engage as much with the American public. And a lot of conservatives, of course, believe that the Constitution is very much meant to be a restraint upon popular self-government, and that the Constitution may have a kind of elite tilt to it. Well, that's partly true, but Wilmore Kendall shows that the Constitution and the Federalist Papers and the fundamental American political tradition, in fact, basically endorse what we would now call populism, and specifically a right-wing and quite localized form of populism. So this book, The Conservative Mind, is extremely valuable, and I've written a new introduction for it, which I hope brings it out, really shows people why this is a must-read. And the book is newly republished by Regnery.
I think you said The Conservative Mind. You meant to say The Conservative Affirmation.
The Conservative Affirmation, that's right. I always have Russell Kirk's classic, The Conservative Mind,
on your
mind. Brain. But right. That's right. The book that I'm talking about is The Conservative Affirmation by Wilmore Kendall. And I think that listeners to the Tom Woods Show will not be disappointed if they pick it up. They'll find a lot of ideas that will challenge them, a lot of ideas they won't agree with, but they'll really come away with an understanding of populist constitutionalism and of the Constitution itself, even beyond what they may have gone into reading this book possessing.
Okay, so I'm going to take a look at it myself. I'm sorry to say, even though I feel like I've read an enormous amount from this post-war period, I have not read that book before. So I'm going to read it. I'll read your foreword. We'll get you back to talk about it. I misspoke, by the way. The show notes page for this episode is, as a matter of fact, tomwoods.com/2199. We almost had you on for a round number episode, Dan, but it's tomwoods.com/2199. So we'll have Modern Age. We'll have a link to this book and Dan's regular links there. So Dan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody, that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, our old friend, but who has never been a guest on the show, which doesn't mean he can't still be an old friend, Lou Perez joins us. He's a comedian. He's got a brand new book out called That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore. No, I'm not referring to the song by the Smiths, but his book, That Joke Isn't Funny Anymore, subtitle On the Death and Rebirth of Comedy. So that'll be a lot of fun. Make sure you tune in. If you like and appreciate the Tom Woods Show, join me as a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com, and we'll be chit-chatting before you know it inside the Tom Woods Show Elite private group. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.